Welcome to the Media Roundtable. We're bringing together industry leaders to restore trust in our nation by supporting content that's good for business and culture. And we're doing this in a live workshopping environment. I'm your host, Dan Granger, and today we're joined by Will Phipps. Will is the SVP and media lead at Allen & Gerritsen, where they focus on emotional connection, which they call humanity planning. He is also the co-founder of Protect Our Press. That's what we're going to be talking about today, which takes what they describe as a fair trade approach to marketing. It is designed to change the balance of power back to independent publishers with the goal of preserving local journalism in communities across America. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. Glad you're here. So buy local seems to be the theme for this one. Tell us about Protect Your Press and what's it all about.
Sure. Well, I think it's an initiative that I co-founded with a colleague of mine, Derek, that in a way has been in its genesis the whole way through my career of 25 odd years. I started off as a media buyer, you know, negotiating space, and my career has spanned, you know, content development, communications planning, and now rounding back to lead the media team at A&G. And we attended a meeting in Boston way back pre-pandemic in 2019, where one of the keynote speakers, Lupa Scarlis, who runs the paid media division for Bank of America, spoke very eloquently about the dramatic decline that's happened to news journalism. And he cited a couple of numbers that really shocked us. Something like 47% fewer professional journalists than there were 10 years ago. And I think there's a nice little nugget is the Cleveland Plain Dealer 10 years or so ago used to have more staff in its arts and culture section than its entire editorial team now. And so that really kind of like, you know, we had drinks afterwards. Most of the agencies present, you know, frankly chuckled and said, well, that's interesting, but, you know, we won't change how we buy media. And Derek came into my office the following Monday and just said, but what if we did something? So it really, it's taken a year to turn, you know, a hopeful vision in keynote on a slide through to a movement that is just, you know, is small but growing. And really it's centered around a commitment. It's a call to action, very much industry focused, asking agencies, brands, publishers, even individuals, just to rethink their relationship with professional news journalism, because it's dying out. And it felt like we as media agencies particularly were so culpable in the demise, because we as media agencies have too often, you know, check the box of saying no to news adjacency because clients may or may not be worried about the volatility of news and where their ads are placed.
So going back to the information that sparked this for you, whatever that percentage was that we have fewer journalists, was that a national figure or was that based on regional news, local news?
Yeah, it's a great question. The thing that, so we started off going, terrible news about journalism, can't we do something? And we're not the only sort of organization, group, or just people who recognize that news is what the only media channel protected in the First Amendment, and that everyone's having a tough time. But the real problem is what Pew identified as the news deserts. So it's something like 20% of metro newspapers are closed in that same time period. So there's now something like 1,300 news communities that have no professional journalism representing them. And when you interpret the world only through unverified news, it's not, you know, fake news is just one of the generalisms for it, but it's really, it's about being unverified rather than purposely false. Then you live your life assessing the world through punditry and opinion, not verified fact. And that process of a newsroom, that verification of fact, which is so central to the DNA of a professional journalist, is what you then lose. And when you lose fact, then how are you really looking at the world? An opinion is fine when you know it's opinion, but do you want the voice of one animated, maybe politically motivated blogger to let you interpret what's going on? Or would you sooner have some professionals who at least care enough to make sure that what they're saying is true? Not saying they get it right all the time, but at least that process is there. That newsroom principle is so important to how we view the world.
Yeah, well, we've certainly experienced that and talk a lot about it here, because you have journalists. Everybody's a journalist now. Everybody's a broadcaster if they want to be. I mean, look at this. I'm a podcaster among millions of other podcasters. And so it's true that, you know, I think society's just trying to figure out, how do we deal with this world where everybody gets a microphone or the ability to distribute to anywhere else? You know, I used to work in local radio, and we had a news team, and they were at the time, it was the biggest news talk station in the country, and just shelves and shelves of awards that they won for original reporting that they did locally. One of the reasons I left that business and started an agency with a focus on podcasts was because I saw that, you know, with the proliferation of content that could be distributed across the internet, local didn't have the same meaning. In other words, you have an affinity with the people that live in your metro area, right? But you also have affinities with people that do the same type of work that you do, have the same values you do, have the same hobbies and interests that you do. And with all the media fragmentation, it allowed for these communities to pop up and start supplanting a lot of the demand that would have just gone straight to publications that were regionally based, whatever format that is. Do you feel that some of the reduction in emphasis on local journalism and local content is supplanted, possibly for good reasons, because we're just kind of reshuffling in terms of how we group ourselves by affinity beyond geography?
It's a great question with, I think, probably several layered answers to it. First, I would say the demise, if you will, of local news coverage, or certainly local journalism. If you forget lazy planning by media people such as myself, it's more because of the local news publications were really caught by the digital world. They were not designed to be. They were a subscription-based model, or you pay for your title and it gets thrown onto your lawn by the paper boy or girl. And they were not set up for a digital world. And so, digital-first companies, even now, feed-first companies. So you think of like a Business Insider as a good example, great digital publication that was designed social-first, trying to get an organization that has an average readership of 60 plus. And that subscribes but's aging out, to then turn it into a digital first operation takes an awful lot. And most, I think you could say, struggled. In fact, still do. You look at the average website of a smaller, regional or provincial news publication, it's not going to feel like the New York Times. It doesn't have the production value, the design, or any of those things. So that decline happened. But you talk about shared affinities. I think what's so interesting is we are on the crest of a bounce back, I think, for local journalism, where the role for that community voice has become so much more valuable because of the pandemic, because of working from home, because local now matters more than it did when you were traveling 5 days a week on business and you were dotting around the US, for certain groups of audiences. And national news, while it had the headlines, it had, Dr. Fauci, it had the kind of the big statistics, it didn't contain anything about what were the local laws going to be? What was the local openings going to be? Where could you get vaccinated? None of those things were available nationally. And because the statewide kind of laws were moving so quick, the publications that stepped into that gap, and in my local market, for instance, in Boston, Boston Globe did a great job, as did many others. But they set up, vaccine trackers. They set up, they piped in that John Hopkins data, but they sort of interpreted it for Massachusetts rather than just nationally. So, and then I would say the social element. So one of those pieces was news and vaccinations and all of those things. But the sort of localization of affinities, I think, is starting to happen. You've got cocktail clubs, book reading clubs, like there are, theater going clubs. It seems to be bubbling back up again, and not just for that older traditional audience, but much more the young professional. And so it's really interesting what's going on. I think there's a real chance for some bounce back.
Okay. So going back to the central mission with Protect Our Press, which is such an outstanding name for a cause.
I'm still jealous of it, Dan. I know you are.
I am very jealous of it. I absolutely am. So it sounds like the way you looked at it was you're like, okay, look, we've got a kind of a drought of professional journalists. And so you've got a bunch of amateurs kind of taking over. We've got this attention economy where the loudest voice gets the most eyeballs and ears. And that doesn't necessarily correlate with quality. Meanwhile, trust in all the major institutions we need to function well in this country is plummeting. And so you're kind of going, all right, this is a big problem, but we're going to eat the elephant one bite at a time. We're going to start with local, restore local first, because you see other people working on the other pieces. Is that a fair explanation? Yeah, am I getting that right?
Yeah, I like to. It's a good analogy. I like to think of it in a way that we're trying to come at it from the grassroots up. And I think many other organizations, including Media Roundtable, is tackling it top down. And I think there's a way we can try and meet in the middle. Like we saw that the biggest, that those being hit hardest were the little ones, because they're the ones who are going out of business. Not to say that bigger news organizations aren't facing their own troubles and pressures. But yeah, trying to meet in the middle is our plan. And I think that the important thing is we want this to have some bite. Like it's, you know, many groups have espoused the importance of professional journalism. The fourth estate. We're trying to get particularly media planners and brands to think about how they invest their money and taking a very serious look at those investments on two levels. The first is the proliferation, obviously, of programmatic media buying. It is the easiest way to reach audiences at lowest cost, connects up in an omnichannel way. You can have video, you can have display media, you can have social, you can put it all together and it's great. But the news adjacency element is the problem. Like too often planners and brands are ticking that box that says no news adjacency, rather than being a bit more thoughtful about it. Sure, you can still weed out being next to topics or contents that you don't want to be next to. So you're an alcohol brand or you're a kids brand, there are going to be certain topics that you know you need to steer clear of. But you can do that. And I think the problem is that it's not happening too often. They're just taking this easy option and going, fine, we'll say no to news. And we want to challenge that kind of lazy attitude. And the second is just taking that call. It's, again, I believe, a bit of laziness that a lot of media planning is done nationally and local is seen as the kind of, do I have to do that? That's for the franchise business or for car dealerships. Like I buy national media as a planner. And it's like, but every brand has a footprint. Every brand has areas of strength. And if they have areas of strength, why wouldn't you want to tap into a vibrant community of audiences, which more often than not actually is that local professional journalism? I'll give you another example. So Boston.com, they recently published an article about the top 20 places to get clams in New England. And the reposted comments and kind of views by the audiences, which were then turned into another article, got infinitely more views than the professional article to begin with. So it's those vibrant communities that brands want, and they're there. We just need to relook at them and go, okay, they're valuable. Let's invest and see if it helps the marketing piece.
So I want to go deeper into the business challenges and implications there. And, you know, it's something that we're not just dealing with the Media Roundtable, but look, as a media buying agency with Oxford Road, you know, I look at local, I go, yeah, what do we actually know about that market? And to become knowledgeable and to, you know, figure out the CPM hurdles and all that. But let me park that for a minute and come back to it. Let's go back to the critical piece, which is, what is the real world impact if we do not change course in local communities?
I heard there was a piece of research recently conducted by one of the big news publications, and they had looked into their readership's view of unverified or fake news, because their contention was people just didn't realize that it was fake. The troubling truth is they do. They get that whatever has popped up on their feed, you know, badge blue or red from a political perspective, they kind of get that it is, you know, one person's view, but it's salacious and it's interesting and it's topic of conversation fodder. So while they know or they suspect it might not be true, they don't actually care. That's the real problem, is that if people don't care about essentially fact or fiction and they put interest above that, or, you know, in a talkability above that, then I don't know. I think we're in a one way slide down to hell. It does matter. It is the vibrant truth around us. If it dies out, then we might as well, shut up in our basements and count down to the end of days, because I really think it does matter.
Well, and of course, it does matter, and truth matters, and us finding a way to agree on truth also matters, because we're having a hard time with that even. Do you have a point of view on that topic, by the way? How do you get two people, two sides, who both believe that their side understands truth and the other does not? How do you navigate that?
It's got to be the biggest quandary of our time. I mean, when I say our time, in the last year or so, I feel like you could say the world is flat.
Yeah.
To someone who disbelieves that, for obvious reasons. Well, I should flip it the other way. Let me start with the science. The world is indeed round, not flat. It's just like things that are just known are no longer known. I think we should have evidence-based living. Is my mantra, and I'm a spiritual person, and enjoy imagination, but there are certain truths which are undeniable, and I do think it's a problem that if someone has an opposing view, it's almost like something has happened where people have decided that just because they believe it to be so makes it so. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. That is the conundrum. How do we fix it? I think it has to be more open, honest debate and less reactionary, refusal to listen. And I would think it's got to come from the top. And by that, I mean, the two major parties of the US, and whichever way you lean, there used to be that middle ground. There used to be bipartisanship. I think there's got to be give and take. And that's like, it's okay to be wrong. You don't have to just say, this is the thing and I believe to be right. America itself has to at least start to have some give and take and debate again, rather than like a true debate, like this conversation. We can have different opposing views, and that's fine. But you can't have different views of fact.
Well, I was just listening to an interview that Obama did with Ezra Klein recently, and he was talking about, how do you get people to come toward your way of thinking? And he said one of the things that he did that helped him become as successful as he was is that he helped start by coming in and really trying to understand the perspective of the other side and being able to articulate their argument better than they could. And when he did that, it showed that he really did understand them. And that even though I understand this position, let me open your eyes to this, but it seems like to me there's such a missing component of trust just from the very beginning that people are immediately in take a posture of defensiveness, and I can't let you in because you're going to harm me. And because there's so much animosity, because we've incentivized outrage and animosity and being adversarial with our neighbors and fellow citizens, is very, very hard to walk that back until I think we had changed some of the style pieces. Because I agree with you. I think there's protocols, there's standards and practices. You can put things through a certain amount of rigor and know that there's going to be problems, but actually have better outputs. But if people believe that everything is rigged against them, if the other side has touched it, then that's a problem. And so, it seems like there's something just very, very human and maybe more right brain than left brain that may have to come first to just get people to feel like, okay, this person's not trying to hurt me just because they have a different perspective on information.
Yeah. I mean, my family used to have a ban on politics. I'll say my US family, my UK one still happily talks politics. And we used to ban on talking about it because we felt we couldn't talk about it without arguing. And what we've realized is that in itself is pointless. So we now do. We just take a deep breath and try not to get too heated, because we have very different sides of the family. It just comes down to an honest discussion. If you can't talk about your disagreements, then, you're, as I said, you're just going to live in a bunker.
Yeah, I think everybody in the country needs couples therapy to deal with everybody else. But anyway,
exactly. Hold hands. It works for everyone.
Yeah. Hold hands. Yeah. Tell me about, like, when you're talking, hold hands.
Well, okay. Yeah, well, maybe is that COVID friendly now? I don't know. I'm just saying.
I know we're way off on a rabbit trail here, but this is interesting. I knew a couple one time when they said, you know, every time we fight, we immediately get naked and then the fight stops very quickly. And so I thought you were suggesting very tactically, like if you hold the person's hands while you're talking to them.
And I'm unbuttoning my shirt as we speak.
We haven't found anything to argue about yet. So far, I feel like we're on the same page. All right. So getting this back on track. So I hear you on the standards of truth, but like real felt impact in a community when they don't have access to local news. We understand that it might help you to have access to national news so you can vote in the presidential election. But like what happens to a community? Do you have any stories or examples of where community loses access to this resource, community suffers or member of community suffers?
Yeah, I wish I had a specific one. I will say where those voices, those trusted voices disappear, others step in, right? That's a known. I do think there's some new kind of digital properties have done quite a good job. Originally it maybe was Patch, which, you know, was that sort of like, you know, individual town type narrative. Nextdoor has actually sprung up quite nicely and is in a way becoming more of a trusted place for localized events than something like Facebook. So that's, I think, a positive influence. I don't have a specific one of what happens when you didn't have the news and then what happened next.
Yeah. So, okay. And I know that on your pledge, you have a suggested quota for how much of a media budget a brand should allocate for local news.
Well, we started with it, and we're realizing that's a little more complicated. So when we launched it, we felt as an agency that that we could move 20% of our existing programmatic budget back towards news adjacencies, and we felt with our client base it was the right thing to do.
Sorry, not just news generally or local?
News generally.
Okay,
let me rewind a bit. So phase one, right? We started with the pledge asking brands, agencies, publishers, and individuals to everything from an individual subscription just to relook at their media plans. And we started for the agency side suggesting 20% was meaningful. And we've softened it a little bit because the more and more holding companies that we've talked to, and we have some really interesting discussions going on, 20% could represent several billion dollars.
Yeah.
That's a big gulp to ask an agency to commit to. So we've instead asked for a meaningful commitment. And I think it's up to that agency to decide what is meaningful and what isn't. So there is a bit of an honesty bar about this.
Of course. And I recognize that the language was expertly written to be practical and allow companies to be supportive and yet, you know, ultimately make the decision on what's best. But where I'm going with the question is, you know, so, for example, you know, Braver Angels, they're the bipartisan group that's trying to get Americans to learn how to talk to each other across differences. So we had their CMO on and he said, look, you know, with a movement, if we can get 1% of the population on board, we know that's the watermark. That's the KPI that the movement will have a life of its own and spread if they can get to that 1% mark. Now, for you, you've recommended 20, which, by the way, is interesting. We had some IAB data in the podcast space suggested that 22% of listenership was on news and news adjacent content. So I think I've always been curious of how that translates to different channels. But anyway, do you have a threshold or a metric that not just what you're asking individual companies to pledge, but do you see a definitive line at which point, if you can be successful when you cross that, there will be a really material outcome?
Yeah, again, great question. I was asked this before about, is there a number of pledges that you're after? And I'll answer this question the same way, as I don't actually care the number of pledges that we get, because one pledge by a holding company could amount to millions back towards those individual publications.
Yeah.
So to me, it's not that the volume is not in their finite number. The volume is in the money that could then return. What is the right amount of money to get back into news media? I don't know. If I got one story next year from one publication that said, do you know what? Our increasing ad revenues meant we kept the doors open. Then all this work was worthwhile. One of the things we're trying to set up next, I said, kind of like phase one was you know, building the proposition. Phase two is trying to turn this into a service. So part of the problem these individual publications have is if they choose to sell their media programmatically, they get cents on the dollar for what they would usually buy direct. Now, usually they sell it because they can't sell enough direct, so they do have this remnant inventory, but they're getting nothing for it. We're trying to set up what we're terming a fair trade programmatic marketplace, or PMP, which would allow those smaller publications to sign up, and the demand side kind of sales piece, the technology company would agree to charge less fees than they usually would, which means they would get more money. The publications would get more money than usual. So that is beyond challenging brands and challenging agencies to just plan better. We're trying to find a better way for publications to sell, and to sell not as much as they would get direct, but it's up to them how much they sell, but at least get a fairer amount of money. So that's our sort of our vision, is to set up this fair trade PMP.
Well, and I'm very much aligned with that in how we're approaching Media Roundtable, which is like, yeah, there are some milestones we think would be meaningful to hit, but you can't tie everything to the milestones. And if you can move anybody, then you've had some amount of success, right? So we try to look at the habits more than the scoreboard. Because one thing I am slightly concerned about, you've got a lot of companies invested in this idea of doing well by doing good, being a purpose-driven brand and committing to causes that are important to them. I could see this as folding into that very nicely, but the problem is they've got a lot of competing pressures to give a certain amount of funding to all kinds of causes. I don't know if you saw the Byron Allen lawsuit where he's asking McDonald's for $10 billion for not spending enough money with Black-owned media companies. And so if you're a corporation, you're looking at a lot of these recommendations, you're going, okay, we want to do good, but there's all of these kind of different causes that we need to allocate toward. Where do you draw the line? And what do you do in the quarter, the fiscal quarter, after the Dow drops 10,000 points, right? Like, what happens to all those pledges and all those commitments? And I'm not sure that we're on a super sustainable path, because it's hard enough to stick to one good intention pledge. So I think the pledge is a good thing, but ultimately I think you're right to focus more on the spirit of the effort than everybody to a specific number.
I think it's also up to news to prove itself a value in terms of marketing, which is what this boils down to. Like, we can have a philosophical discussion about the importance of local professional journalism, and we'll both be totally aligned. In marketing, right, where performance goes, the money flows, essentially. So we believe that news adjacency is the right place to be. We've done, you know, research ourselves. You know, 71% of the US regularly reads more than 30 minutes of news in some form a day. So it's a big audience, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
those news readers versus news rejectors are, you know, 17% higher household income. That means more disposable dollars. From some of our performance work, they're proving 20% more effective with news adjacency media than versus non-news adjacency media. So we've already been doing some work. So we're prepared to recommend to clients, just like a good broker would, we think this is a valuable environment to put your brand because we think the performance will prove out. We've then got to see if that is still true. If it is, great. If it's not, do we need to pay less for it to still get that performance? But you know, we're trying to lay the groundwork to say news reading audiences are valuable, and we think they'll have a benefit to your brand. I'd argue exactly the same case for diverse and minority owned businesses as well. And you know, we have a passion commitment to that as well. You know, but marketing still has to work. So, you know, few brands unfortunately have marketing budgets that are cause driven. So we are ethical about the way we plan it. We recommend what's right for clients, not just because we have a passion for it. And we have to see if it works. And if it doesn't work, maybe we try another tactic. Maybe instead of, you know, display media, we should be trying emails with these publications, like there's, or events, you know, or sponsorships or any of those things. So there's a whole bucket of tactics that each of those publications can offer. But ultimately, you know, marketing is designed to do one thing, right? Sell something, whether it's a service or a product, it's still selling. And if it doesn't work, you know, the natural law of, you know, Darwinistic media planning means you spend less in the things that don't work and spend more in the things that do.
Well, and I can corroborate the importance of news and news adjacent content for performance marketers. Most of the businesses we've been doing business with since we opened our doors have been a lot of D2C brands, and everything is metric driven. Everything is ROAS or CPA, it's performance metrics. And without question, this has always been the format that performs best on an impression for impression basis. The thing that helps performance marketers, honestly, and this is before 2020, I mean, this is going way back, but brands have always, I think, had a hard time affiliating with political content of any kind, and news gets so political that the performance marketers actually end up getting it for a lower CPM than they would have otherwise if it were more brand safe for them. But ultimately, impression for impression, it always works better. Even if you are arguably reaching, like I've tested this, where you are reaching on paper the same demographic or same qualitative in an audience with two formats, but one is news or news talk, one is interest of any other kind. News wins almost every time. So it definitely works. Talk to me about CPMs. How much of a effect?
Dan, you're going to put the audience to sleep on CPMs.
I know, but it is important. And our audience is primarily comprised of people that are in the industry in advertising or media. So I think it's important. Let me talk to you about what the Media Roundtable really is. It's not just a podcast, it's a movement. Negative polarization is making all of us miserable. We've talked about how 80% of Americans now believe that the country is falling apart. And meanwhile, private companies are the most trusted institutions in America, while trust in media has never been lower. And the irony here is that it's these same private companies that actually make news media possible through sponsorship. So the Media Roundtable joins together media and marketers and mobilizes them to promote truth and civility in journalism. We're committed to increasing advertiser support for content that shares our values of clarity, fairness, truth, tolerance, respect, and de-escalation. By the way, you can learn more about this when you read the pledge in full at mediaroundtable.com. So if you're in media or marketing, you can make a powerful difference in helping to bind the wounds of our fractured nation without compromising your business goals or your brand values. Media Roundtable is here to help by providing resources and support for our members every step of the way. We want you to get involved. All you need to do is visit mediaroundtable.com and sign the pledge right now. How much of a premium do you have to pay currently to sponsor a local publication versus a national, all things otherwise being equal?
I would liken it to the same as what is often termed as endemic. So let me answer the first question, then I'll tell you sort of the valuations. It's usually 30% more, I'd argue, for local. And that's usually because they're smaller organizations with lower inventory that want to charge higher rates. And many of their advertisers are actually local brands buying direct from them who kind of don't really know what they should be paying, which is why agencies exist, because we have a broader sense of what the value is. So that's what's charged. But and I think too often, again, planners might go, local publication A is, you know, $15 CPM, national publication is 12. Why should I pay that rate to, you know, 15? Right. My argument would be because you pay that same higher rate for what you would classify as an endemic. So, you know, An infant brand buying mum blog content pays that same rate. A motorcycle brand buying motorcycle review content also pays a premium. So local news is just asking for a premium based on the fact that they're experts within a specific topic, which is that local community. The real problem, though, is actually the programmatic CPM, which is $3 to $5. That's the thing that, again, drives it is I'm not sure what percentage of those smaller publications they sell programmatically versus direct. But if you're getting $15 direct and $5 through programmatic, and that programmatic amount is slowly rising, that's also why there's 60% decline in ad revenues. Hmm.
Okay, so let me challenge the premise of this whole thing, which is to say, look, I believe in a free market. I believe that let the best product win. Now, if these local publications are not finding a way to run a successful business in the current environment, is it possible that they should be going away? And that since the demand and the need is still going to be there, that we can have faith that somebody's going to disrupt the industry? Because it does feel like local news, while struggling and needs help, also may be ripe for disruption. How much of this is their fault for not changing with the times and adapting and finding increasing ways to add value?
It's such a mean question, but the truth is that this is survival of the fittest, and it always has been. Yeah. Plenty of, what is it? Too big to fail was what they said about Lehman Brothers. Yeah. And it is the truth is, if you are not what audiences want, doesn't matter how much a brand or an agency might be trying to buy that space, like it will fail. Those that are surviving have adapted, right? They have got more UGC, more involvement with their audiences, and they're reporting deeper rather than trying to compete. So I think the ones that are doing well is like punditry or those unverified types of news will cover every topic in a provocative, 40 character tweet, maybe with a short form article, and just move on to the next bit. Like, it's a bit of clickbait going on. The ones that are surviving are addressing those more profound topics in a more investigative, I reference the Globe just because they're local, but things like their Spotlight series where they really try and uncover malfeasance and things going on. Those are local stories that get national coverage. And there are plenty of Pulitzer Prize winners who I'm sure have served on smaller publications that then broke major stories, because stories can be national, but think how many stories are local, and local stories still can have interest to the rest of the country.
Yeah, agreed. So what, do you have any visibility into local publications that are struggling that you are advocating for them to get more revenues? Do you have a sense of how many of those are actually locally owned versus by some conglomerate
that's fair. Filled them all you've up? Got basically, you've got like the USA Today's, you've got Gannett, they have gobbled up, many, many, many publications and brought them under their banner in terms of their sales. So you can, like, Gannett just launched a local print but national buy distribution. USA Today owns hundreds of titles. I think you'd have to ask them, was it a good thing or a bad thing? Because I think they you start getting syndicated news rather than local news, but then again they kept the doors open. So it's like the devil in the deep blue sea to some extent.
I'm just trying to identify, like, because I just looking at it with as a capitalist and going, where is this going to shake out? Like, how do the interests align and what needs to change? I mean, I can imagine there's a scenario like everything else in the world where the big dollars comes in and scoops up a struggling industry. They figure out how to do things more efficiently, but they keep enough of what's important to the original consumers that it can still be successful and thrive. But it seems like that's the missing piece. Like, they haven't figured out how to bring the magic of what has supplanted them into what they're doing, which is usually what happens. Everybody pronounces an industry's dead, and then the industry reemerges and reinvents. You're seeing this in audio. Audio is a great example. Podcast is starting to skyrocket as terrestrial you know, kind of it'll have an up year, but then it's going to keep going down. But the new version offers a lot of benefits to a consumer that the previous did not. Now you can listen on demand, right? That was never a feature with radio. You couldn't pause your radio or skip or just go to the segments that you were interested in. This is a really interesting adaptation that technology has enabled. And I'm just wondering with local, what else can they do? And are you challenging them for what they have to clean up on their side of the street so that they can, it can, they can be easier to offer help to?
I think audio is just, it's such a good analogy. I was talking to iHeart earlier today. I think they've done a really good job as a obviously national business taking it. You know, radio is as linear as a print publication, right?
Right.
Sure, Sirius XFM, you can buy that, but really you're just buying a linear feed through a satellite. I think they've done a nice job of again, building podcasts, building their inventory that you can then target in a more addressable way. That's the same model that ultimately local print journalism we kind of need to get to from a digital perspective anyway, is, as I said, we're trying to do it in, you know, just as from the ground up with this idea of this fair trade PMP, but ultimately they need to find a way to connect themselves with others to form a viable entity or group that has a footprint. You'll never really sort of get a national media planner or agency or brand to have the time to start all these like 500 conversations with 500 different metro, you know, publications. They kind of need one point of entry. So while the Gannett or USA Today model, I'm sure, comes with some downsides, at least it does give that footprint, right, of some kind of regional and local buying. So.
Yeah, hopefully the efficiencies can start to make some of that up if it has to go that way. But I'm excited for the moment when that comes back. And even, you know, focusing on audio, I'm waiting for local podcasts to become a force. It hasn't gotten there yet, but I know it's coming. I know it's going to get there. And when it does, I think that, you know, the national ones are going to lose a lot of share of what they've been receiving. But, you know, they've got to adapt.
One thing I'm thinking, Dan, is if you don't mind, I'd love to talk just briefly about brand safety, because I've been having this thought, like the very reason that some clients have challenged news adjacency is because of brand safety.
Right.
I'd actually argue that news is one of the most brand safe places to be. Because if you are there, you know, I'm up for some provocation. If you are there in a verified place, the content might be volatile and unpredictable, but it's got to be safer than someone like YouTube, where they've got something like 10,000 moderators, and even that isn't enough. You know, there's brands buying on YouTube that just have no idea where they're being adjacent to, and. And so, yeah, I think we should get this going. News, the most brand safe environment you can be in.
Well, so I'll give you my point of view on this, which is relative to some of the open platforms where the content is user generated, and that sits right next to something that came from, you know, heavily produced, you know, conglomerate owned manufacturer, for sure. The hard part is that I think. You know, like if you're buying programmatically, you could show up anywhere on anything that says, I could say I'm news today and write intentionally, just write lies. And, you know, it could be The Onion, except we don't tell people it's a joke. And next thing you know, brands showing up there, they have no idea. And you get burned a couple of times. But the other problem is it's the partisanship. It is the partisanship. And it is so rare to find, you know, you've got Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know where they sit. You know, the only major national one I'm aware of that doesn't get typecast is like USA Today, where they're more like a third, a third, a third. But everything else gets so polarized. And that's where we get into this mistrust of facts. So even if you're doing what you believe is good journalism, you've identified as being on one side of a polarized population. And so you've got the other side immediately attacking you and trying to take you down and attack you for that. And then you layer on top of that opinion content, which can have no basis in fact, which I think you've articulated well, and no delineation for the audience, you know. And let me just go on record and say, we're giving our opinions here. We're not originating news right now. We're not breaking stories. But most people don't disclose that. And the consumers, they're eating junk food all day in their brains. And so I think the problem is real. And one of the things that I would, you know, I would encourage you to join us in is a level of dual-sided accountability. So I believe that advertisers do need to support news. I think that, you know, what the whole focus of the Media Roundtable is this notion that if we can't trust the Fourth Estate to hold power to account, every other institution is going to crumble, right? We need a strong Fourth Estate, but we need to have some standards and practices that both sides can agree to so that it doesn't have to just be the loudest voice winning and everybody continuing to escalate the problem. But if you only hold the advertisers to account to support that, to make that so, and you don't also have accountability pointed at those that are manufacturing, that they need to do better too, then that's a problem. So for us, you know, it's interesting, even in the naming, we talk about Protect Your Press. It is a fantastic name, but it also represents a defense of an institution that is under attack right now or being challenged in the marketplace. But I think there also needs to be a protect our brands, protect our advertisers, and there needs to be a dual set of responsibility. Our relationship is only going to work if I work on my side of the street and you work on yours. Yeah. It's the same thing with these business partnerships. And so I think it's really, really important that we hold everybody to account on both sides.
So I wonder if it's things have changed. If the original Fourth Estate was coined back in my homeland in England.
Yeah.
The nobility, the clergy, and the law. And then the press or the mob was the ones that held them to account. So I think we have to decide who is it we want to hold to account this time. Is it still those three same bodies? Because there's not too much nobility. Maybe you could say celebrity. But I think we should rethink as well. What is the future role for press in a modern world?
Well, okay, so I love that you brought up the origins of the Fourth Estate, because I think you're the first person. We talk about the Fourth Estate in every episode. I think you're the first person that's ever talked about its source, and it is your hometown. So you're well qualified to do that. I think look, holding power to account still needs to be the job of a journalist, is my view. But one thing we've been talking about is that corporations are becoming the Fifth Estate. They're there to now hold the journalists to account, because we've got this situation where everybody's a journalist and the journalists have all gone wild. And so somebody's got to rein them in. Now, what you're seeing is, like, corporations, look at where, you know, what happened. They were starting to build some trust, and then 2008 to 2010 happens. They went in the gutter again. Nobody trusted big bad corporations. Now all of a sudden they're the most trusted institution in the world, and they're going, yes, we're going to solve society's problems. We're going to address these things. And I'm like, okay, that's awesome, but if you're going to do that, how about you don't shit where you eat? Pardon my French on that. But like, if we're funding corporations and sponsoring content that is purely based on exploiting our differences and putting us at odds for each other so you can get more eyeballs, so you can sell more mattresses, that's not congruent with this stakeholder capitalism model. So as long as corporations are going to raise their hand and say, we are purpose driven, then stop polluting society with all of this divisive content.
Here's the ultimate then problem. So if the Fourth Estate called out the other three, and corporations are now calling out the Fourth Estate,
yes,
quis custodiet ipsos custodes, or who watches the watchman? That's yes. The problem. Who's going to be watching the corporation?
Oh, shit. Hopefully. Okay. By the way, I'm going to need to see that written, because we're going to have to title the episode what you just said.
Sounds good. I'll email it to you. But I do. It's a serious point. And years of Latin and being beaten by my headmaster still lets it stick.
Well, thanks to your headmaster, because I mean it's a beautiful way to say it. Who watches the Watchmen really is the question. The Fourth Estate is critical for society. Our problems are, I believe, very much, you know, we talk about politics downstream from culture. Culture is very much downstream from media content, and so holding them to account to give us good for society, trustworthy content and strengthening trust. So much of this just comes down to trust. Do you trust the stuff your neighbor is saying and the bumper sticker that they put on their car? Or do you see them as an enemy who actually wants to destroy everything that's fundamental to your way of life? Media has an influence in that. And we do need to watch them. And so while we're funding them, I think we all have accountability. And that's what I love about Protect Our Press, is you're holding the advertisers to account for that. But I think it's got to be a dual relationship where brands are held accountable for their part, but then those that create are accountable for theirs as well. We'll see if it works.
That we will.
I think that's a good place for us to end. Will you please, though, just tell our audience how they can get involved with Protect Our Press and what you'd like them to do?
Yeah, sure. If you take 2 minutes, go to www.protectourpress.org. Go to the pledge page, sign up. If you need some help, leave a message. We'll try and get back to you. But just try and take an action, whoever you are. If you're a media planner, just relook at those plans. If your client and a client says to you, we don't want news, just have a discussion at least. Publishers, you know, we'll try and help as well, but just try and be more mindful about how you do packages. And then, frankly, a paid subscription to your local publication, that's, you're doing a small thing, but every little helps.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing. It is very important. And thank you for taking the time to come in and hang out with me here.
Thanks, Dan. That was fun.
Very fascinating conversation. This show is dedicated to the notion of E Pluribus Unum and dedicated to advancing our mission at the Media Roundtable of mobilizing marketers to promote truth and civility in journalism. We value clarity, truth, fairness, respect, de-escalation, and tolerance. And we invite you to engage with us at MediaRoundtable.com. And if you found the show helpful and you're committed to our cause, please follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. It's always free. And if you're a marketer looking to live this out, you can always keep in touch with our agency, Oxford Road, by visiting OxfordRoad.com and subscribing to our weekly newsletter, The Influencer. Special thanks to Bianca, Kyle, Jennifer, and the team at Podcast One. Keep coming back.